I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. President Trump is addressing the country tonight from the Oval Office to make his case for the construction of a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border, a signature issue of his campaign that rallied his base and the reason for the partial government shutdown now in its 18th day. Trump is demanding more than $5 billion in funding for the wall before agreeing to reopen the government, while Democrats are offering $1.5 billion for border security and no taxpayer dollars for a wall because Trump had promised that Mexico would pay for it. Here's House Speaker Nancy Pelosi talking to reporters this past weekend.
A wall is an immorality. It's not who we are as a nation. And this is not a wall between Mexico and the United States that the president is creating here. It's a wall between reality and his constituents, his supporters. He does not want them to know what he's doing to Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security in his budget proposal. He does not want them to know what he's doing to clean air and clean water and the rest in his Department of Interior and of EPA. He does not want them to know how he is hurting them. So he keeps the subject on the wall.
Speaking on Sunday, the president backed off from his demand for a concrete wall and made this offer.
I intend to call the head of United States Steel and a couple of other of our great steel companies to have them come up with a plate or a design of a beautiful steel product, which we now make here, and we'll use that as our barrier.
Meanwhile, 800,000 government workers are either furloughed or working without pay. We asked Robert Costa to join us. He's national politics reporter for The Washington Post, moderator of Washington Week on PBS, and he's a political analyst for NBC News and MSNBC. Robert Costa, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be with you, Marty.
You know, back in December, as we all know, the president said he would gladly and willingly own this shutdown. It's now almost into its third week, or I guess it's into its 18th day. Was the Trump administration ready, prepared for a shutdown lasting this long?
Not at all. You have people throughout the federal government at the highest levels scrambling, looking ahead to people not being able to perhaps get their tax refunds from the federal government, issues with the IRS, potential issues with food stamps. And so agencies are in a tough position as this shutdown drags on, as are hundreds of thousands of federal employees who are dealing with the fallout, whether they're furloughed or they're not being paid. But this is a political standoff more than anything. The president saying to his base in the Republican Party, saying to the country that in his view, there is a crisis at the border and that the wall is necessary to be built. They're even considering taking emergency measures, a national declaration of an emergency to perhaps bypass Congress if the president doesn't get his way.
Well, let me pick up on that. We do not know, obviously, what the president is going to say tonight, but there's certainly some inklings that he might talk about declaring a national emergency. Robert Costa, based on some of the reading I did this morning, that's generally been used for a military emergency. Assuming he makes a case of this sort, what is going to be the argument coming from the president?
The argument's been building in recent days, though it is a controversial argument. Experts have disagreed with the president's view of this bleak situation at the border. Is there a migrant situation with people coming up from Central America? Certainly there is. But this exaggerated threat, critics of the administration say, is not a reason to build a wall or to declare a national emergency. But the administration is making its point known over the weekend in meetings with Democrats at the White House. They again presented this view of a crisis at the border that was reiterated on Monday when Secretary Nielsen of the Department of Homeland Security and the vice president met with reporters and talked about how they see this as a crisis. So they've been laying the foundation rhetorically and policy-wise for such measures to be taken. But you're right. This kind of executive authority is usually taken by a president during wartime to direct the Army Corps of Engineers to start construction projects, not necessarily to start a construction project for a domestic policy agenda. And so the president would be challenged in court immediately, and he would be challenged by House Democrats.
Let me play something that's been played several times, but this goes back to Sunday on Fox News, and host Chris Wallace was fact-checking the White House press secretary, Sarah Sanders. She said that thousands of terrorists were coming in at the southern border. Let's play this clip, and then we will chat about it, Robert Costa.
And the State Department says that there is, quote, their words, no credible evidence of any terrorists coming across the border from Mexico.
We know that roughly nearly 4,000 known or suspected terrorists come into our country illegally. And we know that our most vulnerable point of entry is at our southern border.
I know this statistic. I didn't know if you were going to use it, but I studied up on this. Do you know where those 4,000 people come or where they're captured? Airports.
Not always, but certainly a large
number. The State Department says there hasn't been any terrorists that they found coming across the southern border from Mexico.
It's by air, it's by land, and it's by sea. It's all of the above. But one thing that you're forgetting is that the most vulnerable point of entry that we have into this country is our southern border, and we have to protect it. And the more and more that individuals know that.
They're not coming across the southern border, Sarah. They're coming, and they're being stopped at airports.
So what's the truth there, Robert Costa?
Chris Wallace of Fox News is accurate here that this list of suspected people that is compiled by the federal government, most of these entries are made through airports, not at the southern border. But the administration continues to maintain that there is a crisis at the southern border. If there is a crisis at the southern border, based on the Washington Post reporting, it is a humanitarian crisis. You have all these Central American migrants seeking asylum in the United States, many of them families, and they come to the United States looking for that asylum, but there are not often enough beds or enough health facilities or living facilities to deal with a lot of these migrants. We've seen some children pass away in U.S. custody. That has caused an uproar on Capitol Hill. And so you have Democrats saying to the administration over the weekend and on Monday, you need to provide more money for humanitarian needs at the border. And the administration is countered by saying, we'll put some money on the table for that as long as you give us the $5.7 billion we want for the wall. And the Democrats keep saying, we can't have this kind of negotiation until you reopen the government. That's why we have this stalemate. And the president's stepping back tonight, and he's saying, I'm going to go to the country with my message and with this cause and see how the country reacts. But it's as much, Marty, about keeping the Republicans with him as anything. The Republicans are getting skittish. When I was at the Capitol this week and the weekend, they're worried about this government shutdown, the political costs they may pay. And the president, as much as he's telling the country about his view tonight, he's trying to say to his own party, hold the line.
Let me quote Julia Ainslie. She works at NBC News, as do you. She says U.S. Customs and Border Protection encountered only 6 immigrants at ports of entry in the U.S.-Mexico border in the first half of fiscal year 2018, whose names were on a federal government list of known or suspected terrorists. She goes on to say that at the northern border with Canada, there were 91 people on this terrorist watch list. Just, I think, adding to what was said on Fox. And how do you think the president can counter that if it's coming from his own government?
The president's counter is going to be immediately fact-checked by news organizations and all of his claims about immigration. And it's been a debatable subject for whether networks should air his speech. Networks sometimes decide not to carry presidential addresses, but this is President Trump's first ever Oval Office address to the country amid a government shutdown. So most networks have decided to carry it. But his claims will be under scrutiny by Democrats, by the media, by his own party, by Republicans, because the president has had power for the last 2 years before Democrats won back the House. He's had an opportunity to pursue a border wall. It is only now, it seems, with the government shut down, with divided government here, that he's calling an emergency situation, a crisis at least, a situation. And so that the timing of all of this and the language he uses is something that is a real political flashpoint. Is this partisan driven or is this actually driven by facts on the ground? And each line will be carefully fact-checked tonight.
About a year ago, sort of in a similar situation, though, without the shutdown, where the Democrats offered $25 billion for a wall in exchange for support for DACA. What happened to that offer? And, of course, that was extraordinarily generous compared to what we're talking about today.
And that's something history will look back on, Marty, and say, just like the president decided not to do infrastructure first and decided to pursue Republican priorities on health care and tax cuts, what would it have been like if he had accepted that deal, trading protections for Dreamers, the DACA program they call it, in exchange for $25 billion for border security and border wall funding? It would have made sure, at least at some level, a new barrier was built at the southern border. But it's a story of politics. The president ideologically couldn't bring himself, even though he has made some noise in the past about doing so, couldn't bring himself to actually provide more protections for Dreamers, knowing that would aggravate many on the right about if he ever made that kind of deal. Yet because he walked away from that deal, here we are today, the government shut down, and he can't even get his $5 billion he wants for the wall.
And we know that government workers are having to pinch pennies and are, frankly, suffering, some of them.
Certainly. The Washington Post has done extensive reporting on this over the past 3 weeks. Federal government employees across the country. I mean, people often think of the federal government, they think of Washington, but the federal government is a sprawling operation across all 50 states. And it has been a real challenge for many of these federal employees, not knowing if they're going to get paid, when they're going to get paid, how long this shutdown is going to last. Their lives have been upended. And the thing is, this shutdown was not really predicted by the administration as something that would stretch 3, 4, 5 weeks. Of course, the president has threatened it could last years, but most people thought there would be some kind of agreement within a few days, if not a week or two. And now here we are. They're really looking at some more severe consequences as different programs expire or need to be re-upped by Congress at the end of January or February.
Where does this leave the Democrats? Are they in control of what happens next?
Yes and no. The House Democrats have leverage because they're newly empowered. Speaker Pelosi has said she's not going to do anything on the wall. She won't even deal on immigration until the government is reopened. And she feels like she's in a politically strong position because the more she holds the line, she is getting cheered by Democrats and Democratic activists who say, you can't deal with this president who's so aggressive in his negotiations, who won't back down from his demand for a border wall. But the Democrats are also aware that the longer the shutdown stretches on, they too pay a political price, not maybe as much as President Trump on some fronts, but they pay a political price because just like the Republicans, they're part of the federal government. People sometimes want to see the government functioning, but they're trying to see who's going to blink first. And the Democrats want the president to blink on the wall, reopen the government, and then have further negotiations. But this fight, Marty, defines divided government for the rest of the year. Whoever comes out of this stronger, Speaker Pelosi or President Trump, will have the upper hand for much of 2019 about who really can endure political fallout and political tense moments.
Almost out of time here. Where or why is Senator Mitchell being so quiet?
Senator McConnell?
McConnell.
Mitchell, another former majority leader, George Mitchell, right?
Yes.
But Mitch McConnell is being quiet because he knows the president himself is the negotiator here, and he doesn't want to get ahead of the president. He's dealt with these negotiations before, and he knows the president's word is sometimes fluid, to say the least. Mm. And so he needs the president to settle on what he wants to do before Senator McConnell starts making any kind of deal on the side.
Well, I know you're a busy fellow, Robert Costa. Thanks for making time for us on Radio Times. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. National politics reporter for The Washington Post. We'll be traveling along that U.S.-Mexico border after this very short break. Stay with us. I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. One of the big applause lines at a Donald Trump campaign rally was build the wall. And now that promise of a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border has led to the partial government shutdown, now in its 18th day. President Trump first promised a 30-foot tall wall of concrete, and now he's promoting a steel barrier. We were curious about the look and shape of that 2,000-mile border. What's been built? What's river? What's open space? What's private land? What's United States? And what's Mexico? Our guest Dennis Wagner flew the length of the border in a helicopter for the Arizona Republic and USA Today and was part of a team of reporters who got a Pulitzer Prize for their 2018 series, The Wall, Unknown Stories and Unintended Consequences. We have posted that series on our Facebook page. Dennis Wagner, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Dennis, you flew this border back in 2017. It's now the beginning of 2019. How much has changed, you think, in the last year plus some months?
In terms of border security and,
yes.
and the barrier,
yes.
Very little, almost nothing has changed. There is no wall. No wall has been built at all. There has been replacement fencing and some new fencing, but not in areas where fencing did not already exist. Everything that's been built under the Trump administration is where there was already barrier.
Now, we're talking about 2,000 miles. How much of that border is either has fencing or wall or some kind of barrier?
So think of it this way. There's two types of barrier that already exist. One of those is a vehicle barrier, and that covers about 300 miles of border. And then there's another 350 or so miles that has pedestrian fencing. So less than one quarter of the border has fencing that is designed to stop human traffic.
And the rest stopping vehicle traffic.
Well, there's about 300 miles with vehicle traffic, so that leaves, in a 2,000-mile border, that leaves roughly 1,300 miles of border that has zero fencing.
Now, we're up here, obviously, in Pennsylvania, so you know, I hear lots of talk about the wall and the fence, and you say that really those two words have kind of gotten melded together. Help us understand, and already we're hearing from the president that it's some kind of a steel barrier that he's now promoting.
Right, and it's pretty important to understand that the dispute here is, I don't think, is just semantics. As a candidate, President Trump was a candidate. He was emphatic that the existing barriers are what he called a joke. And he wanted a wall that he said would be better than fencing. And he said it would be taller, more powerful, and more secure. And so far, none of that has been built. In fact, the president set up a system for contractors to propose prototypes, and they built prototypes, and none of those has been accepted.
Ah, interesting. Now, as you flew along, first of all, how long did it take you to fly? This is helicopter, obviously. Fly the 2,000-mile-long border.
Well, we were flying it, and so it wouldn't take this long normally, but
right.
It took us 10 days. And the reason it took us 10 days is we were doing something called LIDAR, where we were actually tracking and videotaping the precise border. Most of that is right in the middle of the Rio Grande River. There's 1,200 miles of Rio Grande River on the border in Texas. But we were surveilling the border, so it took longer than just a regular flight.
Did you see people trying to cross the border?
One of the biggest or most shocking takeaways for me was the volume of illegal immigrant traffic that we actually spotted. I covered the border for 5 years in the probably one of the most difficult times, shall we say, in terms of border security, when on any given day you could just drive anywhere near the border and see illegal immigrants if you were attentive. On a 2,000-mile flight over 10 days, we saw zero illegal immigrants crossing the border. When we talked to Southern Arizona ranchers, they hadn't seen any on their property for weeks and months. We spent time with Border Patrol agents at the border, some of the reporters on our team did, and at a forward operating base where it's out there where the heavy trafficking is supposed to be the biggest problem, and they didn't capture any illegal immigrants during our stay with them.
And yet people are trying to cross the U.S.-Mexico border, correct?
There's still traffic coming across. There's no question about it. It's just not even anything like it was years ago. In fact, you know, when President Trump took office, the number of apprehensions along the U.S.-Mexico border was the lowest it had been in 40 years.
And why is that? Yeah, why is that?
Well, there'd been a ton of, first of all, under President Bush, George W. Bush, there was fencing built, barriers built along border cities. And fencing does make sense in many locations, especially along urban areas. So that slowed down some traffic. And then secondly, under the Obama administration, there was a huge amount of buildup of the Border Patrol combined with virtual fencing. heat sensors, motion sensors, photo pole cameras, all kinds of surveillance devices that enhanced what the Border Patrol was doing.
Would it be possible to build a wall along the U.S., the 2,000 miles along the U.S.-Mexico border?
They built the Panama Canal. They built the Great Wall in China. It's possible to build a wall just about anywhere. The question that we were trying to ask, or the questions were, should it be built? And if it should be built, where should it be built? And would it stop illegal immigration or smuggling? And if it did, what would the cost be and who would be paying for that?
And what were the, and we know some of the answers to that, but overall, what was your conclusion?
I would say the overriding conclusion is there's never been a cost-benefit analysis for the type of wall that Trump proposed. In fact, the Government Accountability Office says Customs and Border Protection has never even analyzed the effectiveness of the existing fence. So we know a wall can be built, and barriers do work in key locations. The problem is sorting out what those locations are and what kind of barrier should be going up.
Let me just reintroduce you. That's Dennis Wagner. He's a reporter for the Arizona Republic and along with USA Today, part of a team of reporters that got a Pulitzer Prize for a series called The Wall, Unknown Stories and and Unintended Consequences. And we asked him to join us on Radio Times because he has flown this wall. And we have put up that story on our Facebook page so that you can travel along the wall and see what it is that he saw. And you can also join us, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Dennis, let me read a couple of comments. A Facebook comment from Shani: the wall is utterly unnecessary. An email from Kyle: walls built for political purpose, for example, the Berlin Wall, seem to always come tumbling down. You can always go over, under, and around a wall. An email from Hugo: what other examples of a border wall exist in the world? The DMZ between North and South Korea doesn't even have a wall. The only examples I can think of are former Berlin Wall and the Great Wall of China, something, Dennis, that you mentioned. How much along the U.S.-Mexico border, how much of that, especially on the American side, is privately owned?
Well, a huge amount of it is in the state of Texas. I'll first explain Arizona, New Mexico, and California. Years ago, under President Theodore Roosevelt, a 60-foot wide swath adjacent the border was declared to be federal property for security reasons and for other reasons. So in that area, the government can claim ownership of the land where the border exists. In Texas, that swath was not created. And in Texas, the vast majority of the land is privately owned. We did an analysis of what happened under the Secure Fence Act. And what happened was the government had to condemn and seize private property from American citizens. I think there were something like 400 court cases filed to seize their property. And it was a royal legal battle. Something like 90 of those cases was still going on 9 years later. And it was a huge expense to get that property.
And we're talking about eminent domain, the idea that the government can,
That's exactly right.
Seize this property, obviously pay the landowners. You talk about lots of litigation. Did the government win those cases, or did landowners win those cases, or was it a mixed bag?
Well, I think the ones that weren't still ongoing had been settled. So in a settlement, there's no declaration of who won. Maybe the landowner said, you're offering me X amount of dollars, I think it's worth Y, and they came to some kind of agreement.
Do people living along the border, I'm sure you can, there'll probably be multiple answers to this question, do they want a wall or a fence or some kind of border to protect themselves from people undocumented coming into the United States?
You're right. There are multiple answers, but the vast majority of the people that we spoke with who actually live along the border and know the border for various reasons object to a wall. Some of them, many of them, for example, ranchers in southern Arizona believe in a fence. a fence that has that the Border Patrol can see through, so they know what's on the other side. But probably more than a fence, they want enhanced enforcement by Border Patrol agents. In Texas, most of the people that we spoke with are deadly opposed to a wall. They feel that it will cut their properties up and it will damage the border community, which is pretty homogeneous and has huge economic implications for the cities and towns along those in that border area too.
You're saying the towns, the cities along the border, there's a lot of crossing back and forth between that border, between people living on both sides?
Sure. Not just, there's economic and there's also cultural. There are families that live on both sides, and the wall has become a symbol of cutting them off from one another for many, and so that's problematic. And then you've got things that you might think counterintuitive. When I was in Texas, we were talking to some guy at a little restaurant on the Mexican side. He was an American guy, and he was a hunter, a deer hunter and a hunting guide, and he was horrified by the idea of a wall, and I asked him why, and he said, well, because if you put up a wall along the Rio Grande River, that will block all of the wildlife in Texas, especially he was concerned about West Texas, which is really dry, would block all of the wildlife from West Texas from getting to the single primary source of water in the whole area. It would be devastating. So you just have all these different takes on it.
Let me ask you, you talk about the Secure Fence Act of 2006. This goes back under the Bush administration, and the fact that there were lots of parcels of land that were seized by the government for some kind of barrier. I'm curious whether that act is still in place and whether there are efforts to try to continue the seizure under this particular act of 2006.
You know, I don't actually know if the act has any elements of it that are still ongoing. The act was basically a funding mechanism, and the funding authorized, I can't honestly remember the exact amount that the funding provided, but it was to build a certain number of miles of fencing. They almost completed the number of miles that was required, and then the Secretary of Homeland Security declared that the functional goal of the Secure Fence Act had been achieved. So they did not add any more miles.
Let me get Paul from Edgemont to join our conversation. And Paul, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, good morning, Marty.
Morning.
And your guest, I forget the name, sorry.
But, it's okay. Dennis Wagner.
I recently saw a clip where Trump was lecturing people as if we were all three-year-olds to say that the coyotes, the people who smuggle people across the border, would just be able to hit the wall, make a right, you know, drive down as far until the wall ends, make a left, and as if it was that simple. It was the most stupid kind of description of why we need the wall. But what is there any reality to that whatsoever?
Paul, I'm going to see what Dennis Wagner has to say. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. Dennis, go ahead.
So, sure, there is a reality to that. Where they have fencing, people either go over it or they go under it or they go around it. And part of that is driving to the end of the fence and dumping a load of undocumented immigrants who cross the border. One of the conundrums there is that the illegal immigration has been forced so deep into the desert that you have way more deaths now of migrants trying to get through, sometimes hiking 5 days through just the most bleak desert you can possibly imagine. So, yeah, there's truth to that. You build a fence and people are going to try to go around it or over it. That's just the nature of this game, and I don't say game in a pleasant way.
I hear you.
But one of the things that's important to understand about this idea of fencing and how much we have now and how much isn't fenced is if you look at what's not fenced, it is some of the most difficult countryside you'll find anywhere in the United States. We're talking about along the Rio Grande, much of the Rio Grande River cliffs of up to 1,200, 1,400 feet high on both sides. So that's two walls 1,400 feet high. It's hard to imagine anyone arguing that a wall needs to be built on top of that. In the Barry Goldwater Military Range near Yuma, you just have this bleak, empty, God-forsaken desert that goes on and on. There's no road access anywhere near in some locations. In the Atascosa and Pajarito Mountains of southern Arizona, just jagged, unclimbable peaks that a wall on top of those peaks would make no sense. So it's a question of deciding where it works, where it's effective, and if there are maybe humanitarian issues, there's all kinds of issues to discuss. But first, you have to try to analyze all that.
Well, you even say, we're almost out of time here, that the wall first came up when, I guess it was candidate Trump, was in Laredo, Texas, or this was 2015. What happened?
Well, I think he went to Laredo to deliver a message that this issue, which has a really kind of a gut-wrenching impact on people, whether they're for it or against it, this issue was going to become the iconic symbol of his candidacy. Mm. And he wore his, that was the first time I believe that he wore his Make America Great Again hat as well. And it was an idea that people could latch on to, and the thing that we're all looking at, trying to figure out, is how you translate that slogan or that mantra into action, and what will work.
And how to get Mexico to pay for it. Dennis,
yes, exactly.
Dennis Wagner, thanks very much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. He's an investigative reporter for the Arizona Republic and USA Today Network, part of a team of reporters who won a Pulitzer Prize in 2018 for the series The Wall, Unknown Stories and Unintended Consequences. We have posted that series on our Facebook page. Much more after this short break. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. President Trump has made himself perfectly clear how he feels about undocumented immigrants. I don't need to play his greatest hits, disparaging them, calling them a threat to the country. So you might be surprised by articles in the Washington Post and the New York Times about employees working at the Trump National Golf Club in Bedminster, New Jersey, using false ID papers and work documents. They claim their supervisors at the club knew they were illegally employed and looked the other way. We asked Tom Hamburger to join us. He's a reporter for the Washington Post, has been writing about these allegations and these workers. Tom Hamburger, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
Good to be with you as well. Let me just give out a couple of ways that our folks, our listeners, can join the conversation. Phone number 1-888-477-9499. Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Any questions or comments to join our conversation. Tom, what's been the response from the president or the golf club or the Trump organization about undocumented immigrants working at this golf club in New Jersey?
Well, as the president is, Marty, as all your listeners know, has been very focused on border security, the need to build the border wall, and we're expecting more discussion of that this evening. People in the Trump organization, both attorneys and spokesmen for the Trump organization, have said in the past that they take the rules around hiring documented workers seriously, and they've said if anyone breaches those rules, they would be terminated. We've had no specific report in the last few days to our stories revealing the additional comments of employees at the Trump Bedminster Golf Club reporting the presence of undocumented workers at that facility.
Well, let me pick up on that. You write about a former kitchen employee, who worked at this club, a woman named Emma Torres. Tell us a little bit about her, what she was doing at this golf club.
So Emma Torres, as you just mentioned, is an immigrant from Ecuador. She told us last week that while she was working at the club in 2016, she knew that then-candidate Donald Trump was getting had Secret Service protection, and that one day the kitchen employees, she worked in the kitchen, were informed that they needed to provide their names to the Secret Service. Torres said that she told a human resources official at the club that she did not have papers to live legally in the United States, and that being asked to submit her information for a clearance check was unnerving to her and to others. And as she described to us then how that official at the Trump Golf Club in Bedminster then excised the names on a list to be turned over to the Secret Service, excised the names of Latino employees who were not fully documented and thus lawfully working at the club.
So what that implies is that there were people who had not been vetted by the Secret Service working at a club where candidate Trump was either having lunch or dinner or playing golf or spending time.
Yes, I think there are two things of significance that we took from these accounts that are offered by these workers, and these are the two points. One would be that it seems to it would seem to show, if the reports are accurate, that people inside the organization, people in management positions, were aware that there were undocumented workers at the facility, number one, seeming to run contrary to the president's claims currently and his claims as a candidate that he did not approve of undocumented workers being employed at U.S. facilities, and two, would not do so himself. The second area of concern has to do, Marty, with what you just mentioned, and that's the Secret Service protocol, having security around a presidential candidate or subsequently, in the case of Donald Trump, the security around the president of the United States depends on the Secret Service knowing who's there, being aware of the identities, being aware of these individuals and potentially any violations of law or criminal past that those individuals coming into close contact with the president or the candidate might have.
How do you fact check someone? We're talking about Emma Torres, who's in your article. The New York Times has also interviewed a number of these women. How do you fact check what they are claiming?
Well, that's one of the big challenges for us, of course, and one of the things that was significant to us is that Emma Torres and another employee at Trump Bedminster, a woman named Victorina Morales, who was also, as you mentioned, quoted in the New York Times piece, were willing to talk to us and talk at some length, providing specifics and allowing us to use their names and their identity. In addition, both of these women have retained an immigration attorney, Annabelle Romero, based in Newark, who told us, and we met with the attorney as well separately, he told us he's now representing five immigrants who say they had worked at Trump's Bedminster Club without legal status in recent years. And so in addition to talking to those three individuals and getting their statements on the record, we also asked to see some documentation, pay stubs in the case of one of the employees were provided to us. We also saw the fake IDs that were submitted to the Trump organization at the time that they gained employment. And so there were documents that we saw, and then we were able to corroborate their accounts by talking not only with the two of them, but with their attorney and with one other person who had previously worked at the Trump Bedminster course.
And they are claiming or alleging that these fake that the management at this golf club in New Jersey, that they knew that these were fake IDs.
Marty, that's one of the issues that we asked about and are continuing to explore. The employees claimed that the fake IDs were actually supplied to them, that they told when they applied for the jobs, they made clear that they did not have the IDs. That they did not have legal documentation that would qualify them as documented workers that could be hired, and that the employer, in this case Trump Bedminster Golf Course Club, was aware that they did not have the IDs, and then arranged directly or indirectly, we're still exploring how this happened, ways for them to get identification which would permit their employment.
And that's Tom Hamburger, our reporter for the Washington Post, talking about a recent story, a series of stories alleging coming from workers who worked at Trump's golf club in Bedminster, New Jersey, that they used false ID papers and work documents, and that their supervisors at the club knew that they were illegally employed and looked the other way. Let me read an email from Ari. He says, I have family members who live in New Jersey and California. They keep voting for politicians who want to expel illegal immigrants, but they employ mostly illegal immigrants in their businesses as well as at home, and they pay them a fraction of the normal rates, concluding saying it isn't only Trump. And do you think, Tom, that this is just even beyond the president, a bit of a window into what's really going on in a lot of businesses in this country?
Marty, yes, thanks to you and your listener for that point. What's being described here is an everyday practice at businesses in every part of the U.S. It's particularly associated in hotels and golf courses, things with the Trump Organization, which the Trump Organization is involved. But what's being described here is really part of the way the system works. And one of the reasons that we're interested in it at the Washington Post is that it does describe an everyday experience, a part of the labor and hiring process in the U.S., and also a critical part of the U.S. economy. But it's a part that is not very often acknowledged. And I did, Marty, just want to come back again and mention that the Trump Organization has issued this statement in the past, denying that they had any knowledge that undocumented workers were being hired at their organization. And what they've said is that they have very high standards. The president himself has said there are systems in place to vet employees, and that if any employees were found to have been hired on false documents or in any way improperly, that they would be immediately terminated.
And these women that have come forward who worked at the golf course in New Jersey, are they still employed by the Trump Organization?
Our understanding is that, and what we've been told by both Emma Torres and Victorina Morales, is that they are no longer employed at the Trump Organization.
Do they face possible deportation?
Well, I think that is one of their, obviously, one of their concerns is that could happen, that they and their families could be at some risk, and they expressed that fear and that concern to us. Their lawyer, Annabelle Romero, is obviously taking that concern into account. He has told us that he has presented this evidence, including the fake documents and so forth, and a rough summary of the testimony of these two women and their three co-workers who are now his clients, that he has provided it to both the Justice Department and to the New Jersey Attorney General's office. And I think one of that his theory, as I understand it, and the way in which he's pursuing this is to consider that these women in are coming forward courageously in his view to report a kind of systemic wrongdoing. And there are, as he described it to us, provisions in the immigration code to protect people who are, in a sense, blowing the whistle or participating as witnesses in a matter that might concern law enforcement. So I believe that that is their strategy or part of the strategy in this case.
Do you know where, for instance, Emma Torres is living?
We do have that knowledge because we've talked to her, and she's in the Northeast, and so are her coworkers at the moment in the U.S. Some of the employees, we're told, are former employees at Trump National Golf Course in Bedminster, have left the country, as we understand it, but most are still here.
You quote Trump when he opened his hotel in Washington, D.C., quote, "We didn't have one illegal immigrant on the job and everybody knows it." How much are you able to determine, or did any of these women say that Trump in any way knew that they were undocumented immigrants working at his golf club?
So, to be clear, there was no indication that Trump personally knew their status. Our understanding from talking with these women and with their supervisors, who they told us were communicating with top people in the Trump organization, were aware of it. But the short answer to your question is no, there is no indication that Trump personally knew of their status.
She talked about some interactions with Donald Trump. What did she say, Emma Torres?
She
is a good tipper, apparently.
Yes, she described this moment receiving candidate Donald Trump telling her she was doing President Donald Trump telling her she was doing a good job and providing a $50 tip to her. And she described the details of what it was like to us working at the club, starting there in 2015 and doing housekeeping. Then because of some uncomfortable interactions with a supervisor there, she moved to the kitchen staff first as a dishwasher and then involved in and became kind of an expert in making pasta and preparing pasta for the dining room and sometimes for special guests. While doing this, she earned $14.50 an hour. That was the salary for the in food preparation. And we're told that the job did not include health benefits.
Will you continue to follow wherever this story takes you?
We're very interested in it, and in touch with and are hoping to reach out to other employees at the Trump Organization, and have also asked the Trump Organization officials, to provide comment to us and any information as they continue to look, as they said, to make sure that all of their employees are following the immigration rules and protocols.
Well, Tom Hamburger, I'll go let you get a glass of water. Thank you for joining us
today
on Radio Times.
Good to be with you.
Nice to be with you. You're very welcome. He's a reporter for The Washington Post and one of the reporters at The Washington Post who's been following the story about employees working at the Trump National Golf Club in Bedminster, New Jersey, using false ID papers and work documents. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and you can also sign up for our Facebook group. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you for joining us.